it became clear immediately to me that we needed to be able to tell the stories of these women. And the challenge with it is that because the injury doesn't exist in this country, because most people have never heard of it, let alone seen it, you have to take them into the reality of what that woman is living with and dealing with on a day-to-day basis before and after her injury. So they can say to themselves, if I had been born there, that could have been my reality. And that's the key. That's the through line, is to try to tell the story so that somebody reading it can see themselves in it.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I am an independent documentary filmmaker, National Geographic explorer, and on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. My guest today is Kate Grant, the CEO of the Fistula Foundation. Before I give you a little bit of background on who Kate is, I want to set some context by defining a fistula. So if you've never heard of a fistula or obstetric fistula, that is completely understandable. It is a women's health issue that gets almost no press, even though it affects nearly 2 million women. And one of the big reasons it gets no press or attention is because it is very challenging to talk about. An obstetric fistula, the kind that occurs in many developing countries, is a hole between a woman's vagina and bladder and is caused by many days of obstructive labor. It leaves women incontinent and often abandoned and ostracized by their communities. And the reason why I wanted to have Kate Grant on the show today is because, as the CEO of the Fistula Foundation, she is tasked with telling the stories of this stigmatized and unspoken condition in order to raise money to fund surgeries for these affected women. So telling effective stories on such a hard topic is the make or break for her business and for a lot of these women's lives. And Kate is very accomplished at telling these challenging stories. Kate joined the Fistula Foundation in 2005, and since joining has quintupled the foundation's revenue, enabling the foundation to support more than 10 times the number of fistula treatment surgeries, while helping to build new women's hospitals in Kenya, Bangladesh, Congo, and Tanzania. The Fistula Foundation has been rated in the top 1% by Charity Watch and one of the top 50 charities in the U.S. by Consumer Reports. And Kate credits a lot of the success to storytelling, which the outside world recognizes as well, because in 2014, Kate was named Nonprofit Marketer of the Year by the American Marketing Association. In this conversation, Kate and I talk about how she tells the stories of obstetric fistulas in a way that audiences will engage with. We talk about the importance of having heart and humility when speaking to others about their trauma, and what advice she has for both storytellers and entrepreneurs when it comes to bringing issues you care the most about to light. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kate Grant. All right, Kate Grant, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. It is a pleasure to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and I love being with you for this. I can't wait for our discussion.
So you are the CEO of the Fistula Foundation. What does a typical day look like for you in any sort of way that you have a typical day? I know you might not have one.
Yeah. What I actually like about my job is that there are a lot of different pieces to the day and that no 2 days look exactly alike. And so if you have a little bit of adult ADD, running an organization is an excuse to sort of dabble in a lot of different kinds of tasks during your day. And I find that very stimulating. But in terms of the kind of things that I spend my time doing, they fall under a couple of categories. I mean, basically what Fistula Foundation does is we're sort of Robin Hood heels, although most of the time I wear flats, candidly, heels are uncomfortable. But we we raise money and then we fund hospitals around the world to treat this devastating childbirth injury. So I'm spending a lot of my time on two sort of core tasks. One is raising money and the other is distributing money. But within those two core tasks is some amount of complexity. We have staff in not only here in California, but we have staff in Kenya, we have staff in Zambia. So part of my job is managing staff, which I like and is challenging, basically building a team. And then thinking about new ways to attract people to our work, which involves, frankly, a lot of storytelling. Yeah. And then obviously the decisions about who we choose to do that work is also interesting and important. So mm-hmm. I could go on with levels of detail, but maybe that'll give you a flavor for it.
Yeah. And how big is the foundation?
Well, we're about $10 million a year in terms of the money that comes in the door. We've got about 25 staff, again, in three countries. We have, last year we did about 8,100 operations. That's for 8,100 different women mm-hmm. and across roughly 25 countries. So that's kind of what we do. We also help train surgeons. We help with outreach and things. So it's not just surgery, but it's basically things that help us get more women treated for mm-hmm. this, again, really horrible injury.
Well, before we get into more of your work with the Fistula Foundation and really dig into how you use storytelling to attract donors and make an impact in the world, just kind of like how before the podcast, you asked me how I got into storytelling, I'd like to hear a little bit of your background. What did you study in school? What were those first
sure.
jobs out of the college? Kind of walk me through the Kate Grant life a little bit.
Yeah. Well, in some ways I'm an accidental altruist. When I went to school, I grew up, you know, Watergate was happening when I was in grade school and high school. The idea of going into a public service career, if you grew up in like the 60s and 70s, was not something that sort of, you know, hit you. I wasn't of the Hillary Clinton kind of boomer era exactly. And so when I got out of college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I really didn't. And I went to a bunch of presentations of recruiters that were coming to campus. I went to Cal Berkeley undergrad. And the one that looked like it was the most fun, because I hate to say that's, again, the accidental altruist part, fun seemed to be like what I was aiming for at 21, was an advertising agency. So I got recruited and actually moved to Chicago and worked for Leo Burnett, which is one of the biggest agencies in the country. And I thought I'd stay a couple years. Well, fast forward, I ended up spending 10 years in that career. I worked for Foucault in San Francisco, Foucault and Belding, big agency, key clients like Levi Strauss. And again, I really was having a lot of fun until I took a trip around the world when I was 27, kind of a, I want to say a mid-career break. I've only been at work for 5 or 6 years, but I went with a friend. We spent 7 months traveling, and most of that time we spent in developing countries. And I would say I really just never came back spiritually completely from that trip, and I couldn't really quite make sense of an advertising career. So I really did some soul searching, some white wine drinking, and decided I really needed to kind of start over again. For me, that meant going back to graduate school. I went back to Princeton, studied international development, because basically, again, all that sort of poverty that I saw, global inequity and traveling through Asia and Northern Africa, decided I really wanted to use whatever abilities I had to address that issue. And since I got out of graduate school almost 25 years ago, I've worked in a variety of jobs, this last one for almost 15 years. But
Kate, can I,
working
can I,
in ways to address poverty. Is that too long?
No, that's great. But I wanted to...
Okay.
See if there was any specific example that you can remember. I think it's that trip around the world. I mean, for me, when I first got really involved in international reporting, like I mentioned to you before, it was that trip with Nicholas Kristof that was like so huge for me. And there's lots of like small examples that I could point to and say like that was a moment that I changed. Was there any moments that stick out to you from that trip that were the reason something stuck to you when you got back home?
Yeah, there were, I would say, sort of a series of moments where, for instance, watching, and this is my gender lens coming into development, sitting in like a cafe. This was actually in Morocco, but in sort of a more remote part of Morocco, and watching women struggling with like what seemed like a whole bunch of kids, you know, a large family size, as we were sitting in a cafe, and there were no other women in the cafe. There were only men in the cafe. And what I started seeing there, which came into crisper focus in India and Nepal, we went through what was then Burma, Myanmar, Indonesia, was what felt like an inequity of labor distribution, where you'd have men seemingly being able to take advantage of leisure time and women being in rural settings almost beasts of burden. So I would say there wasn't a single moment. It was sort of a growing sense of like, whoa, this is different. Mm. Yes, I grew up in California. I grew up in a relatively liberal environment and, you know, was raised with parents that thought I should go to college, even though, you know, the first girl in the family, there was no gender inequity there. I realized that I was looking at things through a lens of obviously privilege, certainly economically, but also that there was a gender lens to things that I had not seen before. So what I started seeing was both, you know, poverty and the inequality that brings that poverty on, but then a gendered kind of poverty around even opportunity about how you spend your day that changed the way I sort of look at things pretty dramatically. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah. And so, okay, so then you studied international development at Princeton, and then coming out of that, what did you do next?
I went to Washington. I worked on the House Foreign Affairs Committee staff. I got very lucky because it was the Clinton administration had come in and basically taken a lot of people out of senior jobs in the on the Hill. And so there was a vacancy that hadn't been there for like 17 years. So I got a relatively senior position at that point working for Congressman Lee Hamilton, very respected foreign policy thinker on the Hill at that point. And he took over the leadership of the committee and basically said, I don't want political hacks. I didn't really have political experience. I want people that have substantive experience in coming out of a graduate program, studying population health in graduate school. I got that job. But as the fates would have it, a year later, the Congress turned and went to the other party. Newt Gingrich came over and took the Republican side of the Hill. I mean, took the Congress into Republican hands, and I was a Democratic staffer, so I moved into the Clinton administration, worked for the head of AID for a couple years. So, frying pan to the fire, but an incredible experience and a ton of work.
So, when you were moving into that sector, you had spent 10 years, a decade, at this ad agency, and you know, as this conversation will touch on storytelling, of course, a lot. What lessons, if any, were you thinking about as you're making this career change of like, okay, I learned this at the ad agency to do this. Now I can apply it to the work I'm doing here.
Yeah. Anything. You know, it's interesting is it now I can see that I learned a bunch of things in that 10 years that have been extraordinarily helpful to me in building the foundation. But frankly, for me to leave a career behind where I was leaving behind you know, I was at a senior most senior woman at this ad agency I worked with. I started to make money at a, you know, window office of the Bay. I had to sort of paint that all black in order to leave it behind. So if you'd talked to me when I first got out of Princeton, I would have been like, oh, I'm so glad to now be changing the world and to heck with that, you know, advertising chapter. And I really wasn't thinking about the skills that I could integrate into a new career chapter because I'd sort of said, oh, that's just bad. We were just like getting people to buy things and what a, you know, what a pointless endeavor that is. And to some degree, I still think that a lot of advertising is, you know, it's getting people to buy things a lot of times by leaning into their deepest insecurity. So I'm not sure in terms of a career, you know, goal, I'm glad I didn't stay in advertising. But I learned a lot in that I don't think I realized, like project manager, being able to like break something complicated into pieces, be able to push something forward and get it done. And even pretty immediately on the Hill, when you're looking at sort of complicated policy issues, the ability to sort of pull those apart, figure out which pieces you could, you know, sort of move with individual constituents or others, there's some of those basic skills that I'd honed in an advertising career that translated. And now, I mean, the job I've had for the last 15 years running a foundation, I used a multiplicity of those skills, many of them, and we can talk, and the reason we're talking today, more about that, storytelling and the ability to pull people into a cause that's more exciting than, you know, Bleach or Cruise Vacations or Jeans or whatever I was working on before.
Yeah. Okay, well, then before we get to that, how did you first find out about Well, I guess when did obstetric fistulas become something that you were consciously aware of and thinking a lot about? Which led you to this job?
This one I do have a moment in time. I mean, this one I do have a definite moment in time. Back to that first job out of graduate school, I was traveling for the House Foreign Affairs Committee in August of 1994, and I was with a delegation, they call them CODELs or congressional delegation during a congressional recess. We were doing a multi-country tour of Africa during the August recess. We started in Ethiopia, just come out of a famine, political transformation happening. I was traveling with a group of men, other staffers on the Hill, one congressman, and because I had oversight for population development health, somebody said, you should go to this hospital, this fistula hospital. You should go look at that. And the guys went off to a different meeting. And I said, that's great. I'll go over there. And I went by myself. And in a cab on the way over, I'm turning over the word fistula in my head and thinking to myself, well, let's see, Ethiopian history. I know they were occupied by the Italians like in the 1930s. And fistula to me, and I know this sounds silly, but it sounded to me like a proper Italian name, like a Mario fistula, or I'll have like a fistula sauce on that pasta. It sounded to me like a proper name. And I obviously hadn't studied, I wasn't an MD, but I'd never heard the word fistula before. Well, I got to that hospital that day, and the woman who runs it, this incredible woman who's still alive at 95, who'd started with her at that point late husband, he died the year before. You know, I saw this Florence Nightingale ward of all these young women and then had this injury explained to me. And I remember it was so meaningful. Those women weren't that much younger than I was. I thought at that age, what was I worrying about? Who knows? But it certainly wasn't that I had a hole in my vagina. I was incontinent and an outcast, which is what the reality was for all those women. The fact that you could sew that sort of hole up to basically create a happy ending with surgery, and that the OR was right down the hall, it was mind-blowing me. I walked out of there and I said, like, God, make it married or inherited. If I ever had money, I would put it here. Now, of course, right out of graduate school, I had some debt, modest debt. Thank you, Princeton, for not giving me a lot of it. I had an old Honda and I was single, you know. So fast forward, I still don't have my private money, but I'm raising money. But I really just – it moved me so much because these women were so young, horribly injured, but yet there could be a happy ending with surgery. And I remember that day like it was yesterday. And so again, I fast forward now, I'm raising money. A lot of my time spent raising money to get other hospitals like this one that sort of changed my life funded. Mm-hmm. As a footnote to that, at the end of this long August, you know, trip, I was going up to the International Conference on Population and Development, Cairo, the last big sort of you all come global conclave sponsored by the UN. And the plan of action that comes out of that meeting is on 180 some pages long. And Austin, if you run a word search on that document, and it covers everything you could think of, male involvement, contraception, migration, you will not see the word fistula. So it wasn't just me in my cab trying to sort through the word fistula and what it meant. The world wasn't paying attention to this issue. And 180 pages, if you couldn't get fistula, you know, in there at all, I think it says you had an injury that was affecting the poorest of the poor and people weren't tuned into it.
And so why do you think that no one was talking about
why?
It?
Why? Well, I think one of the things that's changed, and I give the UN some credit for this, the UN, UNFPA, kicked off a campaign to end obstetric fistula. That was about 14 years ago. And I think for the field, that in a way became a game changer. The UN may not be known for running exquisitely effective and efficient programs, but what it has proven, I think, to be an incredible asset and just a unique entity is sort of rallying collective world opinion about something. And so the fact that you had the UN embracing this, they still have a website, they had put staff against it, they would host meetings. I'm on an international expert advisory group with, 100 or so other people around the world to help kind of move this issue forward. So I give the UN some credit. Now, programmatically, they're not running a ton of programs funding them the way we are now. But in terms of being able to step forward with the stature of kind of the global multilateral leader, they really did that. And I think that's important. U.S. government also, I mean, U.S. government's coming to the end of a dozen years of support for fistula, but they also kind of leaned in. And then obviously our organization that's grown dramatically in the last decade, doing more, or at least shortly more than the U.S. government or the U.N. has kind of come in as well. But it's not just our organization. There's others that have played a really important role.
So those are instances where people are making a difference now. But do you think that when I would do the word search on that document, I wouldn't find it? Were people not talking about fistula at all?
Because
it's just really hard to talk about, or what?
Well, I think it's a couple things. I had actually studied at Princeton. I thought about sticking around to do a PhD in demography because I find the reproductive health to be very interesting, and PhD in demography is sort of a way into that field. But even in all the literature, even the stuff that I was reading for health classes and population classes, I'd never run into the word. So it wasn't like I was coming out of, an MBA program, or coming out of a program in something completely unrelated. The fact that it wasn't on the agenda there, which also it's consistent with it not being on the UN agenda. So why is that the case? Well, one is, like, 94, the internet really wasn't a thing. So you didn't have this kind of global resource that you carried around in your pocket that allowed you to connect people and things together. So what you had was some academic literature. And if it had not gotten on the screen of academics and it was affecting the poorest women, usually in remote or often in remote areas, in rural areas, certainly, I think that's why it wasn't on the agenda. The other thing is, so political agency, a poor woman, often illiterate in a developing country, doesn't have much political agency. The other thing is, and this it makes it different than some issues, is that it affects vaginas, rectums, and bladders. Those are tough organs to talk about. I don't care whether you're in Dubai or Dallas. People do not want to talk about vaginal injuries that lead to incontinence. It's just a tough topic. So you combine all that stuff together, and it just wasn't on the agenda. Mm-hmm. At all.
Yeah. So I guess now would be a good time. I'll drop this into the intro, a little description. But
okay,
if you could give it a description of what an obstetric fistula is, because we've touched around
sure.
it a little bit, but just a concise definition that we can go
sure.
off of for that.
Okay. An obstetric fistula is a childbirth injury. It happens when a woman stays in labor too long, where basically the labor is obstructed. The baby usually doesn't get down into the vagina even. The baby is just pushing usually on the pelvic floor trying to get out. And what happens is, if a woman had that kind of labor in the U.S., like I did, you, after some amount of pushing, they would wheel you into an operating room and have a C-section, and you'd have a healthy baby and a bruised ego like I did, and everything would be okay. But if you're in a hut in a developing country, that's not going to happen. So the injury is basically caused by that pushing of that baby's head. It cuts off oxygenated blood. That oxygenated blood that's been cut off doesn't then supply vagina, rectum, bladder with the oxygenated blood it needs. And what's happened is that tissue dies, and the tissue sloughs off and leaves little holes or holes. And it's those holes that are literally called a fistula. A fistula is just a general medical term for a hole between an internal organ and the outside world that shouldn't exist, and a hole that shouldn't exist. So fistula is actually treated when a surgeon goes up and sews those holes up so that you don't have women leaking urine and sometimes feces as well.
What does that result in after the childbirth? Obviously,
okay.
the tragedy
okay.
that
sure.
that happens with a mother losing her baby. But now they go home, and then the story continues
sure.
for these women.
Well, so here's the really just profoundly heartbreaking array of events here, Austin. So that woman goes through this labor. Again, the labor that would have ended up with a C-section here, she'll stay in often for days. It's not until that baby's usually born stillborn that the labor stops. So she's been in labor for multiple days, the kind of labor that here you'd get an epidural or some other painkiller for because it's so intensely painful. So you've gone through all this pain. Your baby has died. So all this pain and this extraordinary heartbreak of a stillborn child. You go to sleep and then you wake up wet. And you may think, oh, it's just, the remains of the labor, only discover, no, the leaking won't stop and you're incontinent. So that's really, really bad. Well, Then bad is we can't fix you, go home. Or maybe you go home and they just send you home and you'll think you'll, you know, if you sit long enough, you'll be okay. It'll sort of repair itself like a wound. And of course, that doesn't happen. And that woman then often, too often, is ostracized. Why? Because if you're in a hut, which is where a lot of people, for instance, sub-Saharan Africa and rural areas live, that has a dirt floor, you don't have hot and cold running water, you don't have multiple changes of clothes in a closet like all of us have, you don't have depend pads or however you would deal with incontinence if you had it in a developed country, that woman often is ostracized because of the smell, and that sometimes she's blamed actually for her own injury. It's tragic, and sometimes words fail. It makes me it's just so tough. These women usually are very young, and nobody deserves this to happen to them. Nobody.
Yeah. And it's a big problem. Millions of women who suffer from this, correct?
Yeah, we go by the lowest estimate out there because we're optimists. I mean, the UN will say 2 million. We say 1 million because, again, we're going to be optimistic about that number. That said, with roughly a half of the births in sub-Saharan Africa any given year happening at home without access to emergency obstetric care, there's more fistula happening every year, if you understand, because you don't have the means to stop it from happening, which would be a C-section for an obstructed birth.
Right. So I first heard of fistulas from the journalist I've mentioned, Nicholas Kristof. And I wrote down this quote that I'd like to read that will kind of get us onto this topic of telling stories around this. And so here's the quote. He said, "The condition is invisible because it distastefully involves sex, odor, and private body parts, and because victims tend to live in impoverished countries and already have three strikes against them. They're poor, rural, and female, and thus voiceless and marginalized." So I'm really interested in so much of that, especially something being invisible. You know, I, as a storyteller, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do this documentary I'm working on maternal health in Zambia was because I knew a lot of the health circumstances that were causing a lot of tragedy around the world were invisible. And I thought, I want to challenge myself to try to bring visuals to this, to bring emotion to this story, to get people to care. So at what point when you came into the Fistula Foundation, did you realize that telling stories about this was going to be crucial for your foundation's success? And then how did you go about figuring out what type of stories resonated with the public audience and donors?
It became clear immediately to me that we needed to be able to tell the stories of these women. And I don't think necessarily my advertising experience was necessary for that. I'd like to think anybody with a heart and a head could have figured that out. And so we've actually had a section of every newsletter called One Woman's Story. And we sometimes will protect, depending on what the woman wants, change her name or something to not you know, again, mention her for reasons of confidentiality, if that's what she wants. But the idea is to bring our donor into her life and into the circumstances that got her to this tragic place. And the challenge with it is that because the injury doesn't exist in this country, because most people have never heard of it, let alone seen it, you have to take them into the reality of what that woman is living with and dealing with on a day-to-day basis before and after her injury. So they can say to themselves, even if they're, you know, agnostic, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, maybe not literal God, but this notion that if I had been born there, that could have been my reality. And that's the key. That's the through line, is to try to tell the story so that somebody reading it can see themselves in it. And given the reality of someone living in that sort of three strikes you're out that Nick was mentioning, who's such an extraordinary storyteller, that can be challenging, but that's what we aim to do. which is so someone sees themselves in the story, or they see their mother, or they see their wife, or they see their girlfriend, or they see their sister, they see somebody else or themselves that mm-hmm. could have been them.
So taking this one woman's story from your newsletter, how are you going about finding those stories? Who is doing the interviews with these women?
Yeah.
How do you get these stories?
Well, actually, as part of take you into the weeds here, part of the grant application we have with the partners that we fund, because we fund organizations, we have grant agreements. Those are actually like contracts. But in the actual application, we ask for stories. And we say up front, not that they're going to be chosen to get money because of the story, but we say from the very beginning, our ability to continue to open hearts and minds and therefore wallets rests on our ability to talk to the people that give us money. On your behalf, we want to talk to them about what you're doing. And there's no more powerful story that you can help us tell than the stories of your patients. So we actually ask for stories from them in the grant application. And then often we'll go back. We might not even use one that was in the grant application, but that we've established a relationship based on we want to really understand. We want to be able to tell your stories to the people who support us and therefore support you. And in terms of we've made it somewhat free form as to how they tell that story, how much detail they give. We also give them sort of prompts about the kind of things we're interested in, but we don't put words in people's mouths, certainly. And when we have people out in the field visiting from Fistula Foundation, we certainly will have a staffer go in. We have people sign agreements. We have a translator, make sure that they understand, even if they're not literate, that they're telling us our story. Most of the time, as I said, we will change the name. Often we'll take a picture if they'll let us do that. We don't force anybody, obviously. The thing I would say, though, too, as a footnote, is many of these women that I've encountered, as long as you approach them with a kind and caring heart and empathy about what they've gone through, if you approach it that way and you're not sensational about what it is you're trying to do, they're often, if not eager, definitely willing to talk, to tell you their story. They've often been ostracized from their communities, but even within their families. And how heartbreaking would that be to have this horrible injury happen to you and then have your husband leave you, or, you know, your parents disown you, or whatever it is. I mean, the emotional pain that goes along with this physical pain is profound. And so to listen to that, again, with a caring heart, it can open up a lot. And I think you can give somebody by compassion in the act of listening. You're not necessarily just taking from them their story, if that makes any sense.
So in the weeds question again on that, like, because I know you've been in the field and you've told stories and you've had those conversations that are really emotional and challenging. When you approach a woman who's struggling with this, how do you, like, what are some of the first things that you say in that interaction with a woman whose story you might want to tell?
Well, I'll tell you, there's one thing, and I have to give credit to the people that are at the facilities and running them, is that they won't generally have me start talking to someone who doesn't want to talk to me. Mm-hmm. So if you have a ward of 20 women, one of the nurses, and Kenya or Zambu or staff, somebody would have gone around and probably talked to women. And ones that are more reserved or private or still, you know, maybe emotionally wounded, we don't, you know, nobody will push that. So so in some ways I don't think I deserve great credit for showing up, to listen. And I guess that's the one thing that I think learned about any of this is, I can't be in CEO mode if, like, just get it done, sort of drive something. I have to be in a kind of, I would say, sponge mode, but I want to, if I can anyway, even a little bit of their pain, but I want to just absorb. And so minimal kind of prompts and mostly just understanding. And there's some similarities to most of these stories, but there's also the sort of unique heartbreaks or sometimes unique joy of someone who's stuck by them. And to just be very open to how they want to tell their own story, I guess. Mm.
And what types of stories have you found resonated with your audience and donors the most? And I ask kind of thinking about the foundations I've seen that sometimes like pop up on my social media, like their ad campaigns. You know, some of them you'll see like they just show devastating need, just super sad. And some of them are like, you know, just like the triumphant transformation story. And some of them are a balance of the two. Like, how do you think about balancing those two in order to generate money to help these women?
Yeah, I would say that we're probably neither ends of that kind of extremes, if you will. I would say most of the time the women are healed. So they're usually, but not always, is a happy ending, or a maybe not happy ending, but happier ending to her story. But what they've been through, as I was describing earlier, excruciating labor, loss of a child, social marginalization, those are extraordinary physical and emotional wounds. And so we can't talk about the happier ending without also taking people through some of that complexity. And so in our materials, you'll sometimes see happy women. You'll also see sometimes women that feel resolved and strong in a way, but maybe a little bit wounded. I mean, a kind of a determination on their face, but not sort of profound joy. I mean, one of the things that we, I think, do try to do as a matter of I wouldn't say it's actually policy, it's just sort of an attitude, which is that we don't view these women actually as sort of victims, if you will, like, oh, they need us to save them. I mean, yes, they need our help to pay for surgery, but they're often extraordinarily resilient and strong women to have gone through all this. You think about if you were, you know, in a rural area and you'd not spent much time out of your village and you're going to go to a large city and be operated on in a hospital. I mean, just that journey alone is heroic in some ways. And so we try to not make it seem like these women are sort of weak and powerless, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And are there any specific strategies or questions that you ask women when you're speaking with them to heighten the impact of getting an audience to empathize or identify with them? Because obviously, they're people who live very different lives, people who would be donating to your foundation versus these people who are going through this obstetric fistula. What are ways in which you create that identification in the women that you're telling stories about?
Well, I think for women where this is a first birth, and it does happen to women, sometimes they've had children already. So it's not that it's all women on first birth, only the first birth, but it's more common. And so one of the points of kind of familiarity is any woman, I think, oh, not any woman, but most any woman I've ever talked to, as you grow pregnant, and I think about how I was, you know, it starts off as sort of a concept. And then as you start growing bigger, you know, it becomes a very present reality. And there's kind of a mix of excitement and a little bit of fear and trepidation about what you're going to go through, because it's a profound experience, life changes in many ways. And there's anxiety around it, but excitement. And so those women had the same thing. But theirs didn't end up, you know, with, you know, pink and blue, you know, blankets and happy endings. So you can start in the same place of excitement, anticipation, a little bit of nervousness, and see where those paths diverged, is one way.
Yeah, that's nice. And I read one of your, run of your stories about comparing your, labor and delivery to another woman's, and like exactly that. You have these parallel paths, like we're on this parallel trajectory, and then show that divergent, which is really powerful. Okay, I'd also like to chat about men, which includes me, who have a passion for telling stories related to gender equality, women's health, women's rights around the world. I mentioned to you that I I'm working on this documentary on maternal health in Zambia. And when I was out in Zambia, I was constantly thinking about my role as a man telling the story, how that impacts the stories that I'm telling, how it impacts the types of stories that women are comfortable sharing with me, who my translator should be. Like, there's so much that was like going on in my head. And also sometimes, like, I maybe when I'm in a more cynical place, but who knows, you know, I'm thinking, is it my right to be telling these stories? Or I think about criticisms that might come of like, oh, here's this guy from America who's going to tell the stories about women and their health. So I wonder, like, yeah, what you think about the role of men telling these stories. And again, this is coming from a very personal place that I'm asking from.
Yeah, I guess I appreciate that you're sensitive to that, that you know, that you're not part of the, you know, the gender that's affected by this. I guess I don't see that as a problem. And the reason I don't see it as a problem is you're letting them tell their stories. Where it would get to be, I think, a problem is if somehow you kind of paraphrased their stories or talked for them or somehow summarized what they were saying in a way that wasn't consistent with their own reality. That would be a problem, certainly. But you don't have to be a man to do that. There are plenty of women that can also take a story of somebody that's different from themselves and not capture it correctly, or capture it with their own lens of privilege, somehow distorting what they're seeing. So I guess the word I would use is two. Both begin with an H: heart and humility. The heart part is just listening to what someone's saying and trying to understand that and showing up with your full heart. So you're trying as best you can to understand where it is they're coming from, and to be humble about assumptions you're making about them and their experience. That's the part of, you know, being open to whatever it is that they're conveying. I mean, you've mentioned Nick Kristof, and it's in, you know, indirectly, he's what brought us together. And there's not been a stronger public voice for us than Nick Kristof over the last 15 years. A very close second to that would be Peter Singer, the Princeton ethicist, who's done extraordinary amount for us, both through his book, the organization Life You Can Save, that was founded based on his thinking. And it's, again, he's a male. He writes about this issue with empathy and intelligence. And, you know, I wouldn't like what he's talking about anymore if, you know, if his name was, I don't know, something other than Peter. He was a woman. Same with Nick.
So those are both people that they wrote about it, and they have a big platform, a big audience who then looked into your foundation. Is that kind of how that worked?
Yes. Yes. I mean, Nick's been writing about fistula he wrote about it before I started working here. So, you know, 15 years ago, I think he did his first column, and he reports on it every year or two if he happens to be someplace where he sees it. And that's definitely been a through line, because there are other folks that, you know, maybe do, you know, mention it once and move on. I mean, Oprah Winfrey in 2004 did a show back when she had a show, and, you know, God love her in a way. I mean, that's not, you know, 4 p.m. subject matter generally would be incontinent women, you know, and as we've discussed. But she also moved on from it. She did one show and then a sort of a follow-up, and then that was it. She didn't mention it again. I don't think she's mentioned it since in 15 years. So when she's a female, she's, you know, African-American. Some ways she'd be a great, conduit, but she's chosen not to. I'm grateful for anybody who shows up and is able with intelligence, insight, and compassion to tell these stories well. And I personally don't care what that person looks like, as long as they show up with those requisite qualities.
So in a theoretical world in which, what if I did like some story on fistulas? From your experience in the field, speaking with women, what would be some advice that you would have to me to tell that type of story in the most respectful and responsible way?
I think the advice I would give you is to see yourself as almost the producer or a narrator rather than a writer, if you know what I mean, which is if you can get other people, if you're doing a documentary, for instance, if most of what's being discussed is not by you or even in your literal voice, but is you having doctors talk about this, you having patients talk about it, you having patients, family members talk about their, you know, their ordeal supporting their daughter, wife, whatever, so that the voices you're seeing, they're not you. They're not you, you know, Stanford graduate telling stories for poor women. You're basically giving them a microphone and a stage. And then you're sort of orchestrating it a bit so that it is a piece of film makes sense. But that would be the advice. And easier said than done, to put that together in a way that's compelling and thoughtful is hard. You know, you maybe have watched the film Walk to Beautiful. It was done about a dozen years ago, won an Emmy. We were a financial supporter, although I take zero credit because that's what I deserve for the artistry of it. We merely were a funder. But it's a breathtaking piece of film. And the long theatrical version that's an hour and a half, really long, and which tells five different women's stories, and the version that's like 54 minutes that they ran on Nova tells, I think, three stories. They're, other than this one doctor that ran this hospital in Ethiopia, the one I mentioned a while back that I'd gone to in 1994, there aren't Americans or Europeans, you know, talking about this. The story is told by the people that are living it. Now, the filmmakers lived in New York, so the filmmakers were American, but their fingerprint on the final film is almost invisible, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But without it, none of, I mean, it's a massive undertaking. I remember when they were working on it, going and to the film production house, and the editor had, it was like a wall of hundreds of stickies, you know, because he had 100 hours of film. You've been there, done that, of like, how do you tell this by weaving, you know, if you've got an hour and a half, there's probably not any segment usually that's more than 30 seconds or something. I mean, there maybe a little bit longer in some cases, but they're having to weave together and often much shorter cuts than that.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't mean to make it sound like it's, oh, you just get them to tell their stories and cut it together. It's obviously much more complicated to tell the story well. But since you asked for advice, the advice I would have is try to have your voice and your image almost never there.
Yeah. And that's great to hear. It's something that my plan with the film I'm making is to not have any narration. I don't show up anywhere in it. And there are some films or some documentary films where that's very effective to have the filmmakers in it. But that was something that it just, I didn't get that piece of advice before going there, but it just was something that I kind of like felt.
Sure.
Like if I want to tell this story in the most authentic way possible, that my voice probably wouldn't be in it. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to start a podcast like this, where I talk to people like you and other incredible storytellers, because to tell a story where you have no narration and is very challenging.
It is.
Because narration usually takes the points of like transitions and like background context. And
yeah.
I think telling a story with none of that requires amazing foresight from the storytellers who are in the field to know what they need to get so that when they arrive in the edit room, like they have it all there. So that's like one of the big challenges that I'm trying to get better at.
Well, if you haven't seen Walk to Beautiful, I think you can get it on YouTube, and
cool.
I think it's also on Netflix. Since you're a professional, I would suggest you watch the longer one. If you were just somebody less dedicated, I'd say probably the 54-minute one. The longer one just gives you more storytelling. But I think it would be worth your while. So the films you did or the shorts you did in Zambia, what are the topics of those? You mentioned those early when we were talking before the podcast started. So what are your shorts on Zambia about?
The shorts that I've done on Zambia, there's one which is like a profile on this man who works as a carpenter in Lusaka, Zambia. He himself contracted gangrene and had to have both his legs amputated when he was, I think, about 30. And he ended up becoming a carpenter who makes devices for kids with disabilities. So he like hand makes crutches for kids.
What a cool story.
Yeah. And then
how did he get gangrene? I'm just curious what happened. Some kind of infection?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And then
the
story actually ends with him getting prosthetic legs himself and walking for the first time.
Sounds gorgeous. Wonderful. Yeah. What a great story.
And then the other story, the other short from Zambia that I did, or two other ones. One was about Zambia's first circus, which is like a social circus that was started in one of the country's most notorious townships, to get kids to engage with issues around sanitation and stuff, to engage them through circus.
Oh, okay, sort of like the skits and stuff they do. Yeah, that's probably good. Yeah, but fun,
so
though.
I'm looking for an outlet right now for that. And then the other one was about Zambia's national handball team. So a variety of different topics.
How fun, though.
And themes.
Interesting breadth.
Yeah, and on the topic of kind of like, so I asked you about, you know, coming in as a man to tell these stories, and then I also feel like I want to talk a little bit about race. You know,
sure.
We are both white, and obstetric fistulas, I'm not sure if all of them, maybe, but a far, far majority happens.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Women of color.
That's true.
So how does that impact the way we show up as storytellers to report these stories and tell these stories?
Yeah.
In your experience?
I guess I would say, and it's different, the stories we tell, you've got a tougher challenge, because when we tell stories, it's in the service very clearly of hearts, minds, and wallets. And as I said, we do that from the beginning, before, you know, any money goes back and forth, that they understand that's an important part of what we do. So there's no surprises after the fact for them or for us. But we're telling stories with a purpose that helps them directly do what they're doing by raising more money and funding more of their programs or training more of their surgeons. We're in a deeply collaborative relationship that, I mean, I hate the vernacular, but the kind of win-win, which is, if we tell your story as well, we raise more money, we can fund more surgeries or train more of your doctors or help build a new operating room, whatever it is. And so it's not directly, I mean, we don't say there's a certain amount of money we're going to earn from a given story, but collectively we work together to help more women. I think your challenge is a little harder, because it's less clear from the outset what they get out of kind of opening their, you know, hearts and, you know, facility to you. I think that makes it a little bit harder. I think it probably, you know, what you're going to do with the film and who benefits from it is probably a big part of it. The film I was mentioning earlier, Walk to Beautiful, that was going to benefit one hospital, and so that relationship also was clear about they were going to make it, they were going to recover their costs, you know, for the people that got paid to put it together, but it wasn't it wasn't designed to make money. And if money was made, it would, you know, it would go to them. Unfortunately, that even when it was sold to Nova, or maybe not sold, but Nova was given a contract to air it, I think they've still barely, you know, made ends meet on it. If you know, documentaries are expensive and not the most profitable sometimes. But so I don't know if that's helpful to you. I think the other thing, it sounds so just banal, almost brainless to say it, but the more in almost any situation like that you can try to put yourself in the shoes of the other person, the better off and more successful you're going to be. So any developing country hospital I've ever been in has more challenges than they have people, money, staff, whatever, that they're just in the better the doctors and the more dedicated, the more work they have around them. It's always this extraordinary amount of work of, and not just work like paperwork, but I mean, human beings that need care, often that produces extraordinary outcomes, life, death, and a lot of things in between. So being very sensitive to the demands that are placed on them every day. I think also sort of just really respectful of time and priorities that others have. It's, again, that sounds so like, well, duh, but the other thing is, and you know this from the travel you've done, is that money can distort situations, and we're really careful, since we give away money, that we also are, that's the humility part, that we don't use that as a sort of bludgeon to get what we want, or even a bludgeon, you don't even need to use it as a bludgeon. I mean, a bribe even, or some other distasteful act, that we really try to be humble to the fact that that can create dramatic power inequities, and it can get people to do things they may or may not want to do because they feel like they need to get grant funding or something. And we really try to be very top of mind aware of that, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, I've definitely had experiences where I am places and, you know, the people who I'm interacting with, they might be in the background of a shot that I'm shooting or something like that. They see a white male with a super expensive camera, and rightfully so, I don't blame them at all. They're like, why are you here, like, making money off us?
Sure.
You know, and it's led to some really challenging conversations, and I always appreciate those conversations because I always want to be clear with what I'm doing, with the people who surround me. And also, I've found that, like, having those difficult conversations as a journalist has really made me reflect on what I'm doing. Like, what really is the impact of these stories?
Sure. And that's really smart. You learn a lot from that. And it's slowing down and having the humility, humanity, whatever it is, to just listen. Even if somebody's berating you and they don't really quite understand it, it's sort of getting to that place of, you know, I tried to tell my son all this, you know, three words that can get you into out of trouble in a lot of stages of life. Help me understand. You don't literally have to say those words, but in your head is, help me understand why you're so angry that I'm here. Help me understand why you have a problem with this. Help me understand your fears. Whatever it is, it's that's that sponge mode. It's almost deliberately saying, my job right now is not to fight this. It's to kind of absorb it. Yeah. Anger, pain, fear, something that's coming at you, but to try to understand that. That's one of the challenges working in Africa. And it's been the same when I was there in graduate school over 25 years ago, is that an assumption is made that you have more money than the person you're interacting with. And this sort of sad thing is that once you get out of a capital city, or even in a capital city, that's probably a pretty darn good assumption.
Yeah.
And it sets up from the very beginning, like the fact that you even got there on a plane. Mm-hmm. You know, when most people don't own a car, it just sets up a power dynamic that's really, it can be challenging. And I don't have any hacks to that except for, like I said, help me understand, and humility, humility, humility.
Yeah. Well, I think also, I mean, clearly you've mentioned it, like knowing some of that history of, like, knowing this, like, these deep-seated racial inequities that are historical in these countries, colonial history. And I think you mentioned it also early on in the podcast, which is, like, you are never talking to someone who doesn't want to, like, isn't volunteering to talk with you. You're working with local connections and contacts in these hospitals. I think those are all amazing, like, strategies to build that trust. And, like, that's somewhere in my career right now, I'm trying to move, you know, beyond, like, this super, super low budget where I'm just, like, asking my taxi driver to serve as also my translator, to, like, being intentional about, like, I want to hire a translator who is a woman who has this background so that the people I'm speaking with will be as comfortable as possible. So I think having those humility, those local contacts, and I mean, and knowing that history are all great strategies.
Yeah.
So I also wanted to get back to your role as a CEO. A couple questions in regards to storytelling as a CEO of a foundation. Have you seen that your investment in telling stories has paid off? And then also how you think about allocating funds for marketing and telling those stories, because I imagine every dollar you get, you're thinking about, okay, first we got to like cover overhead, and then we we want to give it to the hospital.
Yeah.
And sometimes the telling the stories about this, you don't see that immediate direct impact.
Yeah.
So how do you negotiate that?
How do you do that? Yeah, that's a tough balance. I frankly have probably gotten it wrong sometimes and been too thrifty. I mean, it's only been the last maybe 5 years we've had some corporate support in Kenya. We hired professional photographers. Like if you look at, I don't know, the first better part of a decade of our annual reports and newsletters, probably half those pictures were taken by me. I mean, and they're not necessarily very good. I'm exaggerating slightly because some of our board members, others would take pictures. And I mean, occasionally we'd get some, maybe have a reason to have somebody taking better pictures, but not that we ever hired anybody. And I think that was a mistake. I'm not a huge mistake, like I'd go back and hire a full-time photographer, but I think I was probably too thrifty. But you're right, there's this tension because if I spend money on a photographer, like it immediately that's less money I'm going to have to put into a surgery, or a doctor getting trained or something. And so I'm always thinking about any money we spend, there's a cost to an opportunity cost on the program side, the place the money goes. That said, we've now started hiring, not hiring like we've got somebody on staff as a photographer, but we have hired photographers like to go out and spend a day or two in a given country, Zambia and Kenya in particular, where we've got programs. The other thing we've done in the last year that's been a really good addition that I think was late, again, I'll take the hit for that, not hiring somebody sooner. We hired a really terrific young videographer, someone who'd studied video, only a year or two out of school, not a ton of experience, but she's really creative. And I think our video, it's not going to win awards, not because she's not talented, but just because we do things on the cheap. But I would have done that sooner. We had somebody we were paying on an hourly basis that was, doing part-time work for us. And nothing against that person either. I think we just hadn't made a commitment to it. And once you commit to it, and if you get the right person, which I think we've got the right person for now, that's been helpful. So, it's a tough one to get right. And like I said, I probably have been more thrifty than I needed to be. I have done back to storytelling, the kind that I can do for free, is writing stuff. So I've got probably 35 pieces that I've written in the Huffington Post, and a few recently in Medium where I'm trying to tell stories. Almost all of them have something related to our work. I mean, if I did 35 patient stories, I don't think anybody would necessarily want to read them, but they sort of weave different events in the news, or, I look for hooks where I can talk about our work, but not just in a vacuum that might get sort of boring for people, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And so are you disseminating those stories usually in your newsletter? Is that where the most people engage with them? Or are you also utilizing social media?
Yeah, we do all that. We did hire somebody about 3 years ago, a terrific woman who's got a degree in something that didn't exist when I was in college, which is digital arts, does infographics, social media, stuff for our website, any of the newsletters we do and that kind of thing. She does a lot of great work for us there. So yes, we do social media. We probably could do more than we do. The Huffington Post pieces or other, when we occasionally get, I got a nice piece in The Guardian a couple of years ago. We had a story on PBS about our Kenya program. I mean, the NewsHour did a five-minute nice segment. We had a piece in Newsweek a few years ago. So we definitely repurpose those things, depending on if it's a print piece, like the Newsweek piece, we even literally paid for reprints. We send them out through the newsletter. We'll send them out through email. We've occasionally, I think with the Newsweek one, we sent reprints of that to our bigger donors just to make sure they didn't miss it. Because it's hard to get press for this issue, to sort of bring the conversation full circle, is trying to get attention. It's one of the issues about spending money on on the assets, you know, photography, video, even stories, is where is that story, if we spend money on it, going to get placed where it actually opens a heart, mind, and a wallet? Because it's not an issue that that's kind of, as you say in the newspaper today, it's top of the fold. I mean, in that it doesn't exist here. And so it's hard because of the bodily organs that influences or affected. It's a, like we were talking earlier, the taboos around fistula. It's hard to get, even for really high quality stories, it's hard to get, you know, I say media attention, you know, and that part's hard. If you get high quality content and then it isn't necessarily even, you know, viewed by many people outside of our own universe. It's why I actually bring it full circle. Somebody like Nick Kristof, you know, I used to joke if my childbearing years weren't done, I'd be named my kid Kristof or Nick. I mean, because he's done so much for us, really. And second would be, if I had a second son, it would be Peter or Singer. I mean, those two men have done more for us in terms of the number of people that have heard of us or our work. Anyway. Mm.
That's great. So we're almost out of time. A couple more questions left here on the main show. So I'd love to hear just like, what are the ways in which the world is making progress in terms of helping women who are suffering from obstetric fistulas? And I also have a quote written down that I wanted to read kind of go along with this question, which was from one of your stories in which you quoted an Egyptian obstetrician and gynecologist named Mahmoud Fatala.
Yes, Fatala.
And the quote was, "Women are not dying because of diseases we cannot treat. They are dying because society has yet to make the decision that their lives are worth saving." Are you seeing society changing those views? Are you seeing society change their actions to prioritize the lives of women more? And where are we at with obstetric fistulas, and where do you think we're going?
I'd say it's sort of a mixed bag about prioritizing the lives of women. I've said something similar to Dr. Fatala, but around fistula, which is, it's not that we don't know how to fix this. It's that not enough people have decided that these women are worth fixing. And that day in 1994 that I still remember was that day that sort of was like, wow, this is this horrible thing and be fixed with surgery. And why isn't this happening all over the place so that women don't suffer? But to the bigger issue, you may have heard about this. Last month, there was the fifth annual of these Women Deliver conferences, almost as a replacement for the UN. Civil society has jumped in to focus the world's attention on issues affecting women. It started out really around maternal mortality, but the agenda has grown. Worrying about women's reproductive health is a subset of women having their rights overall embraced. I'd say overall, the world's making great progress. Women have, you know, they're gaining speed economically, politically, health, education, all those variables. You can look at the data over time. Women are making progress. The maternal mortality rate, which is sort of a marker for fistula, maternal mortality is what, you know, obviously the number of women that get killed or die in childbirth. That number also has been dropping over time. Family size has been dropping, which is also good in a way, which is if you have women with the ability to plan and space their children, to space those children out, you have healthier pregnancies, fewer women getting fistula, fewer women dying in childbirth. So overall, sort of the arc here is very positive. For fistula, it's still a very challenging environment for a couple really basic reasons. It's the one that we come back to, like the through line of this conversation. Poor women without enough political agency in rural parts of, you know, developing countries, with an injury that's taboo to talk about. That's a tough sort of agenda. So that is hard. And there's also no easy way through this. Like if you think about areas where there's been profound change, like you think about HIV/AIDS. I took my son to see Angels in America and was trying to describe to him what it was like in the early 90s, like living in San Francisco, or in late 80s when I was living in San Francisco, this plague that was largely affecting the gay community, but others as well, and that there was no cure. It was a death sentence. There was really nothing to prevent you from eventually dying until ARVs came around. Science came in and it changed the whole thing. Unfortunately, with fistula, there's only one solution to fix it, and that's surgery. And there's no fast surgery. There's no weekend course on fistula. It's really a trauma wound. And so the good news is the world's paying attention. The good news is deaths from childbirth are dropping dramatically over the world. The bad news is fistula is just a tough problem to solve. And in a lot of ways, it's a slog, and it's a tough slog to talk about.
Well, I hope I, as a storyteller, can play my part in helping.
Okay, well, we can talk more about that. I want to look at your films.
Okay, so before we wrap up the main show, where can people find out more about you and about the Fistula Foundation if they want to support your work? Where should we send them to do so?
The easiest thing to do in this day and age is just put Fistula or Fistula Foundation into any search engine. We come up pretty close to the top, even if you just put in Fistula, and that's just spelled F-I-S-T-U-L-A, so Fist and then U-L-A. And Fistula Foundation is our whole URL, but we usually come up pretty near the top. We're in the process of doing a complete overhaul on our website. We have a pretty good website right now, but it's going to be like terrific in a few months from now. We're really putting a lot of energy and time into making it rich, rigorous, helpful to people. So that would be
nice.
The best place, I think, to go.
Cool. And folks listening, Kate is going to stick around for our post show after I ask this final question. And the post show is available to those who support the show on Patreon. That is over on patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. You can get access to all our post shows with our amazing guests, as well as additional episodes. And in this week's post show, we're going to ask Kate some fun questions, some more questions that we didn't get to on the main show. We'll ask her what she's watching, listening to, or reading these days. We always like to ask the people that. And then also some resources that have inspired her as a storyteller and as a CEO. So if you want to learn more about how you can get access to that and support the show, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. And to wrap up the main show, Kate, I ask all my guests, you know, what advice do they have for people who want to become better storytellers? And for you, maybe that can also be targeted at those who are entrepreneurs, who run their own businesses. How can we use storytelling more effectively to run those businesses? However you want to take that question, I'll leave that up to you.
I learned to be a better storyteller by looking for stories that compel my heart. There's a quote about when your heart speaks, take good notes. I think that's a good quote about like just paying attention to what moves you in life and following that to help guide your journey. But when you're trying to understand someone else's journey, pay attention to what their heart's saying, I guess. But in terms of getting better at it yourself, I think it's again, see who's telling stories that move you and what was it about that story that moved you. And then that might tune you into how you can tell a story of another. It's mostly just taking yourself out of the equation. So hard to do sometimes, but it's not about you, usually.
<That's right. laughs> Awesome. All right. Well, that wraps up the main show. Kate, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer podcast. It was great to have you.
This is a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
That's it for episode 26 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you to Kate Grant for joining the show and to you for listening. If you want to support the work of the Fistula Foundation, head on over to fistulafoundation.org to learn more. I really enjoyed this conversation. You know, when I was first dreaming up this podcast, I set out to speak to and learn from the world's best storytellers because a lot of the reporting that I do is on issues that can be hard to engage with: international development, health, and human rights. It can just be challenging topics to bring to the forefront of public attention. So I thought to myself, if I can learn from all these amazing storytellers and I can apply those learnings to the stories that I'm telling, I will be able to become a skillful enough storyteller to really make an impact when it comes to bringing these challenging stories to public attention. So having Kate on the podcast, who is tasked with doing that every single day, was an amazing learning experience for me. If you want to hear more from Kate, she did stick around for an amazing post-show conversation where we discussed her favorite storytelling resources, places to travel, and here's a little snippet from a question I asked her about where she saw the state of nonprofits and where she wished nonprofits would evolve.
I would like the nonprofit sector to be much more accountable to its donors and its constituents. I think it's a sector that could really use some shaken up.
So if you want to hear all that, you can listen to this week's private podcast exclusively on Patreon. That's right. Every guest who comes on the show sticks around for a post-show where I get to ask some more fun questions, listener-submitted questions, and it gives us a chance to discuss topics in a way where we really get to let our hair down a little bit. So if you subscribe to the Austin Meyer private podcast on Patreon, you will also receive a personal link so that the private episodes play in your favorite podcast app. You will also get access to the whole backlog of post shows and additional episodes. So head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms for that. And if you want to get in touch with me directly, hit me up on social at AustinMeyerFilms across Instagram and Facebook, at AMeyerFilms on Twitter. Love hearing from listeners about what is resonating with you. And I think that's all I got. So I will see you on the next episode of the Austin Meyer podcast. And until then, go out and tell some stories.